Hello, Sunshines. You're in a click with your host, Jamili Baroud, and it feels so good to be back and to jumpstart season two with an incredible first guest, Howard Bloom. Howard Bloom is an American author and scientific thinker and served as a publicist for musicians in the popular music industry, launching or sustaining the careers of many rock stars, including Prince, Joan Jett, Bette Midler, Billy Idol, Queen, Bob Marley, Kiss, AC/DC, Michael Jackson, and roughly 100 others. Howard Bloom has been called next in a lineage of seminal thinkers that includes Newton, Darwin, Einstein, and Freud by Britain's Channel 4 TV, and the next Stephen Hawking by Gear Magazine. Bloom has a new documentary to be released in April, The Grand Unified Theory of Everything, and he is the author of The Lucifer Principle, a scientific expedition into the forces of history, Global Brain, the evolution of mass mind from the Big Bang to the 21st century, The Genius of the Beast, a radical revision of capitalism, The God Problem, how a godless cosmos creates, and most recently, Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me, a search for soul in rock and roll, which is what we delve into on today's episode. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Howard Bloom. Welcome to the show, first of all, Howard, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for saying nice things about my book. I'm glad you liked it.
I really enjoyed it. Thank goodness it was an easy read so I could get through it quite quickly. And it truly was compelling, and I really appreciate that you were willing to share it with me. As I was reading your book, I wondered by the very end, you know, if I were Howard Bloom interviewing Howard Bloom, what would he ask himself? And so the first question that I came up with was, Howard, what legacy do you want to leave behind, and how does your new book and documentary support your mission or your ethic?
Well, the legacy I want to leave behind for the music field, remember the upcoming book is called Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me, A Search for Soul in the Power Pits of Rock and Roll. And it's my rock and roll memoirs. And the reason I haven't written my rock and roll memoirs before is very simple. I came out of science. I came out of microbiology and theoretical physics, though admittedly I got involved in those two fields when I was 10 years old. And then I realized when I was 13 that I was fascinated by the ecstatic experience and how the ecstatic experience feeds into the forces of history, makes the forces of history happen. And so I ended up in music completely by accident. It was like Charles Darwin managing to get onto the Beagle for 5 years of adventure. And because this is a field, popular culture, I knew nothing about popular culture, absolutely nothing. Right. And I founded the biggest PR firm in the music industry and worked with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Kiss, Queen, Run DMC, Billy Joel, Billy Idol, AC/DC, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, David Byrne, Run DMC, people like that. And so I was a stranger in a strange land. I was like a creature from another planet landing in the world of rock and roll. And so when you ask about the legacy I'd like to leave, the first question that comes to mind, or the first answer that comes to mind, in the music business, I really was on a search for soul. And nobody is doing that anymore. If you came to me as a potential client and said, I want you to craft an image for me, because that was a big thing back then, an artificial mask that I guaranteed would make you a star, I would send you to my best competitor immediately. I'd get you an appointment right there. And if you were going to work with me, I told you, you had to understand that music is not about an exchange of pieces of plastic. It's not about an exchange of downloads. It's not even about an exchange of money. It's about an exchange of human soul, period. When you sit down at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to write a lyric, you're in front of a blank computer screen or a blank piece of paper, and you know you cannot write a lyric. You wonder how you've ever written a lyric in your life. Certainly, you're not capable of writing one today. And on a reasonably good day, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a lyric in front of you. And on an unreasonably good day, maybe once or twice in your life, what comes out of you is so amazingly perfect that it feels like it wrote itself using you as a pipe. So my job in doing your publicity is to find that self within you that wrote that lyric. And I call those selves the gods within, because I've been hunting for the gods inside of us ever since I was 13 years old. And gods. Those are your hidden gods. That is a self so much deeper. I also call it a self below the floorboards of the self. That is a self so much deeper than the self of everyday experience, like, hello, who are you? Fine, thank you very much, and how are you? Mm-hmm. That it defies belief. Then when you go on stage and you have a really good night, you feel the pupils of the audience dilating, opening wide. You see their faces melting. You see them come together, whether it's 180 people or 18,000 people. You see them come together like a collective amoebic blob, a blob of emotion, of energy, of passion. And that blob reaches a pseudopod out to you, reaches something like a tunnel out to you. And the energy of all those 18,000 people comes funneling through you as if you were an empty pipe, goes to something just around the area of your head, is utterly transmogrified and flows back out through you. And you feel as if you are being danced on stage like a marionette. Mm. Well, my job is to find that self inside of you that danced you on stage. That's your soul. That's the gods inside of you. Right. And so music publicity had never been done that way until I landed splashdown in the music industry. Mm-hmm. And when I was forced to leave by illness and by the fact that I had my first book half finished and really wanted to bail out of music and get onto the next phase of my life, my science and writing. So when I left in 1988, there was nobody to replace me. And that aspect of soul has been gone from music ever since. Today, the standard language is the very language that I rebelled totally against, that what you're putting out is a product, that you're putting it out to a market, that you are branding yourself. No, I'm sorry. All those terms are totally inauthentic and miss the point. Mm-hmm. So if I had a legacy to leave in the music field, would try to reestablish that legacy of soul. Mm. But that's just the music field, because then I have broader
goals beyond that.
Much broader legacy to leave than that. But having given you that much, do you want to go into the broader legacy?
Sure, why not? I would love to hear about that.
Okay, so this goes back to the film. You know, there's a 66-minute film that came out about me on November 10th. Mm-hmm. It had its premiere at the Doc NYC Film Festival. And I had never been to this theater before, so I and several other people were walking in the direction that the instructions said we should find the theater. And up ahead, sure enough, we saw what looked like a theater marquee, but it was obviously the wrong place, because there were people lined up four abreast, and they were lined up all the way around the block. So obviously this had to be a Star Wars screening or something like that. And when we got to the theater, it turned out it was the right theater, and all those people were lined up for the film on me. I mean, give me a break. I figure I can get about 40 people in a room, and that's it. This is a 244-seat theater. Well, they were turning people away at the box office. And that film is in part about legacy. I've been very aware of legacy basically since I was 10 years old, because I was a lost child in my hometown of Buffalo, New York. The other kids loathed me. My parents didn't have time for me. And I was on my own. And it was not a nice way to grow up. And one day a book appeared in my lap when I was sitting in our big living room with the velvet curtains. And it said, the first two rules of science are these: the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. The book gave as an example of the truth at any price, including the price of your life, Galileo. And it gave as an example of look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, Anton von Leeuwenhoek, the man who invented the microscope. Mm. So I felt that two men had reached out over a distance of 350 years and saved me, because those two rules of science became my religion. And they have been the core of me ever since. So my obligation is to reach out across the next 350 years and save the next poor lost child down the line. So I write all seven of my books with that in mind. Everything I do has that in mind. And one of the things that's picked out of the film, I never thought of it as being such an obvious and dominant thing as it turns out to be in the film, but my one piece of property is the brownstone in Park Slope, Brooklyn, in which I live. And this building allows me to be a public intellectual and to do whatever the hell I feel is necessary and important and true, which it's a privilege many people do not have.
Right.
So it took us 2 years, but the papers were signed, I guess, about a year ago. And when I die, which you never feel like you're ever going to die, but yes, it does happen. So when I die, this building will go to my biggest fan, who has been there giving me help and support since, well, for 20 years. And his name is Amir Siddiqui. He has a business in Dubai. That's where he lives now. And when I met him, he was in Pakistan. He was the trainer to the stars of the national cricket team, which is the equivalent of being a trainer to the stars of the National Basketball Association here in the United States. And the building will go to him for one purpose, and that is to set up a Howard Bloom Institute and try to continue the ways of thought that I've used all of my life, including this little document that I've been keeping a table of contents on in my computer for about 20 years, called the Grand Unified Theory of Everything in the Universe, including the human soul, which is the big body of work that I've been working on. So that's the legacy. I need to catch the next kid 350 years down the road. I need to if I could ever do it, wake up the people in music to the fact that they're selling pure exchanges of human soul. And there's a message to science. And it's that science, to be science, to live up to the words, to the aspirations of science, science has to look at every aspect of reality it can and try to explain it. And in cases of strange experience, it has to not only try to explain the experience, but to experience them. And experiencing soul and bringing it into the realm of science, what the hell is it? That is another legacy that I'd like to leave. In other words, I'd like to expand science to include the kinds of things that William James was exploring in 1902 in his Varieties of the Religious Experience, which I heard about when I was 13 and had already realized that I was going to need to pursue the ecstatic experience. And it felt to me, I mean, I heard that there was a book called The Varieties of the Religious Experience by William James. And in those days, we didn't have Amazon, and Buffalo is not a book-rich town. So it took me 4 months to find the book. And when I read it, I got the impression that William James was deliberately leaving a whole bunch of ecstatic experiences out like bacterial samples in petri dishes on a lab bench. And he was leaving the lab bench empty, and he was saying, look, you're going to come along 60 years, 50 years after I wrote this. I do not have the tools in my era to understand these things. You will. But in an entire lifetime so far, pursuing these things, most of a lifetime, I've discovered science not only doesn't have the tools to understand these things, it still doesn't even understand that it has an imperative to understand them. And why understand these things? James felt that they should be understood, not just out of his own curiosity, but because he said that those who are able to go to the boundary line between sanity and insanity, and to harvest those experiences are able to turn them into engines of history. Mm. And he was talking about people like Saint Teresa, who, when she went in, she was a nun. She was living in poverty with all the other nuns. When she went into the cold, dark room of her cell at night, surrounded by stone walls, she would feel Christ, God, and angels coming through the stones and entering her and piercing her with something she called most sweet. Mm-hmm. And she built an entire movement that's still alive today, based on those peculiar visions. Mm-hmm. And then there is the guy who, George Fox, who had visions when he was walking down the walkways, mm-hmm. Of the countryside leading to Lichfield in England, had visions of blood raining down from the skies and pouring down the roads. And you'd think, okay, this guy needs to be locked in a loony bin. Mm-hmm. But no, he used those experiences to found the Quaker movement. Mm-hmm. That's, which is around today. And that's what William James meant by harnessing these psychopathological experiences, mm-hmm. As forces of the engines of history. Well, we need to recognize in science that it's not just consciousness. We've come a long way. In 20 years, we have established that we must try to understand consciousness in science. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Because 30 years ago, 40 years ago, no, you weren't even allowed to say a word like consciousness,
yeah.
in science. In mm-hmm. psychology, you weren't allowed to talk about the psyche, mm-hmm. of all things. Well, there is a realm beyond just consciousness. And it is this realm of the ecstatic experience. And I found a true laboratory of those ecstatic experiences in the world of rock and roll. That is where the gods do come alive inside mm-hmm. of us. That's mm-hmm. where the cells below the floorboards of itself take over. That and one other thing that is more accessible to us normal people, and that is sex. In sex, noises come out of you that you don't recognize, and you don't know what they mean, and you don't know where they're coming from, it's because you're being taken over by the cells below the floorboards of the self. Just like a musician is right. taken over by those cells when he or she is danced like a marionette on right. stage.
You say
so those are the legacies.
Those are very noble legacies. You also mentioned in the book something about Michael Jackson, and you had said that he was the one person on stage that did not, he wasn't played like a marionette. He had everything very much planned beforehand, and he rehearsed it and he perfected it. And you also said that he only had one preparatory ritual. Is that correct?
The only one that I know of. Mm. And the one that I had been on the road with him for months before I found this out. One day his manager was sitting with me in a room, and his manager said, look, I'm not supposed to tell you this. Michael doesn't want anybody to know, but he makes me look for two kids dying of cancer who want more than anything else in the world to meet Michael Jackson. He wants two kids in each city. So when Michael is in the 45 minutes before he goes on stage, or the hour, Michael sits with those kids and spends time with those kids. Mm. It was a remarkable experience. It was not like the ritual of any other artist I ever met. Mm. But my other artists, my really astonishing performance artists were John Mellencamp. He was amazing, absolutely mm. amazing. Prince, he was absolutely amazing. Mm. Joan Jett and Billy Idol. Those are probably the strongest. But Michael was able to exceed all of their strengths while maintaining discipline. Mm-hmm. All of them danced free-form. All of them were in the grip of the gods inside when they went on stage. Mm-hmm. Michael's gods inside came to him while he worked out the choreography, mm-hmm. while he rehearsed it. And I am sure that within him, the eyes of that audience did what they do for all the rest of us. Mm-hmm. They bring a sacred fire to your fucking soul, and they set it up ablaze.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that happened with Michael.
Right.
But he manifested it in a controlled and disciplined way.
Exactly. And it sounded like when I read your book that the gods in his soul were just kind of always alive and always existing, and they were always there for one purpose. Or that's at least how it felt when I was reading the book. And by towards the end, it was quite heartbreaking, because I did a lot more research about the falsified feud between Michael Jackson and Prince. And from what I understand, that's kind of what led you from being banished from Michael's tour.
There were a lot of things that the people trying to banish me from Michael's tour used. Okay. And there was no feud between
exactly.
Michael Jackson and Prince. None. Prince did not have Michael Jackson in his mind. That wasn't along his line of influence at all. And Michael Jackson didn't have Prince in mind.
Right.
After all, Prince had been insignificant when Michael was a superstar.
Right.
So, no, there was no rivalry. It's mm-hmm. just that as you know from the book, I had been saying no to the Jacksons for four
mm-hmm.
months. Their manager
right.
kept calling from California and saying that we wanted you to work with the Jacksons. And I said, no, I don't do that. And I hadn't wanted to work with the Jacksons because I felt they didn't need me.
Right.
I thought they were so big that if you put a talking dog on the phone and had it say Michael Jackson, mm-hmm. that it could get covers on any magazines it wanted anywhere in North America or the world, for mm-hmm. that matter. And I don't do automatic things, easy things. I like to do hard things.
Mm-hmm.
I like to champion people who deserve to be superstars but wouldn't make it
right.
without me.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally they called and said, well, we're having a meeting. We're going to be in at the Helmsley Palace Hotel in New York. And the Jacksons would like to meet with you over the weekend. And I had to say yes, because you know from the book, I did not grow up around other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with laboratory rats and guinea pigs and guppies.
Right.
And you don't learn much in the way of social etiquette from lab rats, guinea pigs, and guppies.
Right.
So I didn't know the normal rituals of human behavior. I had to learn them by watching them again, as if I were an anthropologist from Mars.
Mm.
And one of the things that I had picked up on was that if you want to be a mensch, if you want to be an admirable person, if you have to say no to somebody, say it to their face.
Right.
So I went to the Helmsley Palace for the meeting. It was Saturday night at midnight. And the instant the door began to open, I could sense that there was trouble in the room. Something was deeply wrong. And the four brothers were lined up against a wall, sitting there with the backs of their chairs right up against the wall. And it looked like four of the most honest and decent people you've ever seen in your life.
Mm.
Again, something so big and nameless that they can't even tell you. They can't even articulate the fact that they're in trouble.
Yeah.
And as soon as I saw that, I knew there was a crusade here, and I knew that I had to say yes.
Mm.
And it turned out that I felt, it took me 15 years at least to process the experience, but once I processed it, I realized that the brothers had hired me for something without knowing that there was a problem, and it was to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the real problem was saving their brother Michael's soul.
Right.
And that was the task I was pursuing. And
mm-hmm.
somebody was leaking horrible misinformation about the tour and besmirching the names of the Jacksons and Michael's name
mm-hmm.
all over the place. And it was somebody who knew exactly how to manipulate the press, who knew every trick of the press that it had taken me years and years and years to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to track that person down to stop it.
Yeah.
And once that became obvious to the person I was trying to track down, I think he did everything in his power to separate me from Michael.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember, at one point, it was 4:00 in the afternoon. I was sitting at my giant desk in Manhattan with a little red knapsack behind the desk with just a spare shirt and a toothbrush. And I got a call. You have to be out here by 11:00 tonight. Michael's canceling his tour. You're the only person he'll listen to.
Right.
So, I was out there by 11:00 that night, and I convinced Michael not to stop his tour. And it was one of the most remarkable experiences of my life.
Mm.
Whoever realized that I could be used as a tool in this circumstance, also realized that that's why I was a risk.
Right.
And used every story he could come up with, including this absurd tale of that I was a spy from Prince. Give me a break.
Yeah.
to get me off the tour, and finally succeeded.
Right.
And so when Michael died on my birthday in 2009.
You left that out of the book. Did you put that in the book? If you did, I missed it.
Yeah, I think it's in the book.
Okay.
Right? It was a horrible, awful birthday present because I came to love Michael and admire him in ways I did not love and admire. I loved and admired all my artists.
Right.
But with Michael, it was 100 times as much as anybody else. Because remember those first two rules of science, the truth at any price, including the price of your life, the lesson of courage and integrity.
Hmm.
And number two, look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. The law of awe, wonder, and curiosity. Well, Michael was integrity. Every bone in his body, every cell was utterly committed to truth and integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And in his case, the ultimate truth was that God had given him a gift of awe and wonder, and he owed that gift to every kid he could reach,
mm-hmm.
his kids. And the second law of awe and wonder, Michael was that law come to life.
Mm-hmm.
All my life, I've been after William Blake's thing about seeing the world in a grain of sand and infinity in an hour, and I don't remember the lines verbatim, but seeing the infinite in the tiniest of things. Michael saw the infinite in the tiniest of things all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so Michael was the living incarnation of the two rules of science I had learned and had become my religion when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It was astonishing.
Just astonishing.
So when he died, it was like a piece of flesh being torn out of me.
Mm.
It was that way for lots of people.
Yeah.
But I felt now, I mean, I've had this unfinished business with Michael.
Right.
I was never able to deliver on saving his soul.
Mm.
And I've always had imaginary conversations in my head because I wanted to pick up where we left off.
Right.
He was a magical, magical, extraordinarily generous person.
Mm.
He lived to give. And now, all of a sudden, the possibility of continuing the conversation would never come to be.
Mm.
Never again.
It's when I wrote to you that I felt the book was astonishing. That was the part of the book that really, I guess, choked me up, and that I really found astonishing because I felt the trust that you established with Michael. And when you say that you were the only person he would listen to, right, in times of need and in times when things weren't going well for him. And so in the end, when you say that you were removed from the tour and that you never saw him again, I was shocked. I'm still confused as to what Michael could have been told or what could have been going through Michael's mind, right? Like what would have convinced him that you weren't trustworthy after he trusted you so in-depthly?
And I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
No idea. The person who I believe got me kicked off the tour is brilliant at remaining absolutely invisible.
Right.
He's a brilliant man. He has no moral compass. I mean, look, within 2 years of Michael's death, you know how Michael's death tore all of us who ever loved him apart.
Yeah.
Whether we were simply fans or people like me who knew him, it tore us all apart.
Yeah.
And within 2 years, the estate was throwing a press conference, bragging about how it had doubled the value of Michael's estate in the 2 years since he died.
Mm.
Ghouls, vampires, are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
You do not do that with a person, a person who has died.
Hmm.
You do not do that with anybody. You do not try to profit off their death and make more money off of them dead than you made with them while they were alive.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you do, and that's a necessity, because in the case of Elvis Presley, Priscilla Presley's common law husband explained to me that they were about, the bank was repossessing his mansion, and the IRS wanted everything else that he had ever owned,
mm-hmm.
because he was behind in his taxes. And Priscilla Presley managed to, she was on a plane, a private jet, and she called the IRS and the bank, and she said, look, just let me manage this for a year, and I will show you that you can make a profit on it. Mm-hmm. So being able to make a profit, and she turned it around. And being able to make a profit on it was the difference between having Elvis's mansion as a permanent monument or losing it. So there are reasons to try to make money off of somebody's stuff when they're dead, but you don't gloat about it.
No.
You don't demonstrate to the public plainly that you wanted Michael dead.
Mm.
That to you, Michael always meant more dead than alive.
Right.
Well, there's a story in the book about Peter Bogdanovich, you know, the film director who was the blazing genius of 1974 and 1975, and all the studios wanted him. Mm-hmm. And I ended up spending time with him and his girlfriend, the model and actress Sybil Shepherd. And one day he was at the Plaza Hotel in New York. He'd gotten two suites. He'd gotten them hooked together, you know, you can open all these walls into big empty spaces. Mm-hmm. He'd gotten the furniture all changed and rearranged, and he was having a meeting with one of the major art dealers on Madison Avenue, which mm-hmm. is where the Art Clique is headquartered. And his father was a painter who'd never gotten any recognition, and he wanted to know from this Madison Avenue art dealer what he could do to promote his father's work.
Mm-hmm.
And the art dealer said, very coldly, the best way to promote your work is to die.
Hmm.
That's a pretty horrible message.
It's a horrible message, but it's so unfortunate, though, that statement has come true in so many instances, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's a stated fact, right? And it's...
Yeah, well, we gather around at the site of death.
Right.
We are bonded by blood, by the sight of blood. By the smell of it, by the taste of it, we are bonded. And these are aspects of human nature. I mean, I cover some of this stuff in my first book, The Lucifer Principle, A Scientific Expedition into the Forces of History. And yeah, that's how evolution has made us, to be ghouls.
Right.
To flock around those we consider to be martyrs. And you have to be dead to be a martyr.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Hmm.
So, I mean, this brings us to the mythic dimensions and things. And John Mellencamp was brilliant at explaining the mythic dimensions of things. Mm-hmm. So there I was, a science nerd in a whole territory that I hadn't known. A science nerd who had the advantage of, because I hadn't grown up a vinyl junkie like everybody else in the business, I didn't know what the norms and standards were of the business. I didn't know the standard rituals. So I could look over the rituals and figure out and use correlational studies to determine which ones worked and which ones didn't work.
Mm.
And that put me miles ahead of my competitors, even though they had grown up in music. And, well, I had grown up in music, but it had been Rachmaninoff, Bartok, Stravinsky,
right.
Mozart, stuff like that.
Mm. The classics.
So, yeah. And I enjoy playing games, so I enjoyed outplaying my competitors.
Right.
But it was a lot of hard work.
Mm.
So this book was an exploration. I mean, my whole immersion in the rock and roll world from 1973 to 1988, 15 years, was a wild-ass adventure in a very, very strange land.
As you were speaking, one of my questions was, you know, who did you go to for advice? Because I got a feel from your book that the industry, of course, can be quite jaded at times, and not everyone is trusting or trustworthy, because it seems like everyone's been through a lot. So who did you go to for advice, or was there anyone that you could rely on?
There was nobody.
Right.
When I first entered the rock and roll world, it was being named the editor of a magazine, and I hadn't asked what the magazine was about.
Right.
And I'd had this amazing experience where I had been thrown out of the Boy Scouts at the age of 11.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have you ever heard of anybody being thrown out of the Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts before?
I literally laughed out loud when I read that in your book.
Well, it was true, but I've never heard of it happening to anybody else in my life.
Me neither.
And then when I went on my first summer vacation from college at NYU, I wanted a job in writing. I had been obsessed with writing since I was 12.
Right.
And I made a list of the 99 employment agencies mm-hmm. that advertised that they had stuff in editorial, which means writing and related stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I called the first 98 of them and got turndowns.
Mm.
And when I got to the 99th, you know, there's not much left after that. When I got to the 99th, they said, oh, we think we have something for you. Could you come in tomorrow? And it turned out to be a job, a summer job, writing for the Boy Scouts of America.
Mm.
And I wrote for those Boy Scouts about stalking and tracking and camouflage and stuff like that. Look, I can't find my way into a forest, much less out of one. So I researched my tail off with my audience in mind, and I loved my audience. And if I was writing about how to stalk an animal, I wanted you to be able to get so close to a bunny rabbit that you could be rubbing noses with it before it realized you were there.
Mm.
And if you have that desire to serve your audience and the capability to love them, I figured you could write about absolutely anything.
Right.
And so I went into a meeting with a magazine publisher who needed an editor. But we didn't have Google in those days, and you couldn't look the person up that you were going to meet with.
Mm.
So I didn't know what that magazine was about at all. And when I heard the name, which I didn't hear until I got to the publisher's office, it was Circus. Well, that makes you think that it's about clowns and elephants.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be about rock and roll. So that's how I got into the rock and roll business, and it just turns out that it was exactly the place that I needed to be mm-hmm. to find these ecstatic mass experiences that I've been tracking since I was 13.
Right. In hindsight, every piece of your story makes complete sense. And I know that there was a lot of turbulence in your story as well, moments when you feel like maybe your intuition kind of slipped and the soul of artist slipped past you in various instances. And that there are some, like, not necessarily regrets, but what you consider failures throughout your journey. But again, in hindsight, it all seems to make sense. And so what you argue in the end is that the pinnacle of your search for soul ended with Michael. So this entire story, it was difficult for me because I felt like there was so much more to be told, but I guess that's your journey now. But once you were removed from the tour, you wrote that you never saw Michael again. It was one of the greatest losses of your life. And again, the end of your search for soul. And I was just wondering, because I think soon after that you fell ill, and whether or not you think in your core that your illness was somehow connected to losing your connection with Michael as well.
Not really. Mm-hmm. It was, you go on, but I had started going back to my science in 1981. I took mm-hmm. 3 years and read nothing but books about business because it was the second business that I founded and ran.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't trained to do that. I had no idea of how to do it. So I just read obsessively about how to do business things.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was through with that, I was free to go back to my science.
Okay.
By 1984, I'd been taking notes while I was reading, and I'd been taking them on a little micro cassette recorder and then having the cassettes transcribed. And by 1984, I had enough material. Well, I worked out a little 1.5-page outline. A bunch of the rock critics had said, when they heard me talking about these things, oh, you've got to write a book, you've got to write a book. And since I was raised by books, remember what saved me when I was 10 years old.
Right.
It wasn't just two guys reaching out over 350 miles. It was a book in my lap, a book.
Mm.
So, you know how Mowgli in the Jungle Book, he loses his parents,
yeah,
and he's found by wolves, and the wolves raise him.
Mm.
Well, I was raised by books the way that Mowgli was raised by wolves.
Mm.
So writing a book and starting to write books was an absolute necessity for me.
Okay.
And in 1984, I called Timothy White from the Associated Press and Rolling Stone, who'd been encouraging me tremendously, and said, let's have lunch. I've worked out the outline of my 24 cassettes worth of material.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a 1.5-page outline. It was very short. And we sat down at lunch at 1 o'clock, and by 3:30 in the afternoon, this restaurant was very good to me. They let me stay overtime. By 3:30 in the afternoon, Timothy was absolutely exhausted. We'd only gotten through a third of the first page. Mm-hmm. And he said, "That's your book," meaning a third of the total outline. So I started to actually write the book in 1987. Hmm. And I was halfway through writing the book when I got sick. But I wanted to leave PR. And I wanted to be a full-time writer of books about my peculiar perspectives on science. Mm-hmm. I'm an unconventional scientific thinker.
Yeah.
And so I don't think Michael's death had anything to do with it, but it was a big black hole. And you can see from the book, it's still a black hole today.
It felt like a black hole as I was reading it. It really did. I think that you did an excellent job of really putting your emotion into the book in the most simplistic way. It was just so real and authentic. And even though I've had very different experiences from you, I could still relate to you on almost every human level as I read.
That's terrific, genuinely.
Yeah,
that's quite an acknowledgement.
I really appreciated reading it. I really did. And I learned a lot about the industry and was introduced to some artists I hadn't heard before. So I appreciated that as well. So Howard, we only have 9 minutes left. And I feel like I have a million questions listed here. So I hope to be able to chat with you again in the future and really pick your brain. But a part of the show, we play a game, and it's a fill in the blank. So I start the sentence and you finish it. Would you like to play with me?
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent.
I must tell you, I'm terrible at most normal games, but still, go ahead.
You're quick-witted, though, so I think you'll be all right. My favorite Michael Jackson song?
It's Earth Song.
Okay.
When I hear that song, Come On My Pandora, it opens my heart.
Hmm.
It just opens my chest.
Hmm.
And it isn't the words. Because Michael's words were not deep.
Right.
It's the music.
Mm.
It's the music. And music does things to you that cannot be described in words. Mm. Music is one of the greatest mysteries on the face of planet Earth. And it can just open your soul.
Mm-hmm. It grabs you right by the heart sometimes. You really feel it.
Yep. Mm.
I get that feeling when I listen to Who's Loving You by the Jackson 5. My dream artist to work with, either in the past or present, would be?
Oh, my God. What a good question. That's a real stumper.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, back in the 1970s and 1980s, when I was working in the business, I really wanted to work with Paul Simon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, Paul hired me to do the Simon and Garfunkel reunion concert in the park.
Oh, cool.
That attracted 400,000 people.
Hmm.
I can't say he hired me. He hired the company that I founded and ran.
Right.
And then when he and Art decided to do a reunion tour,
mm-hmm.
he kept us on.
Hmm.
But he had a really, really good publicist at Warner Brothers, his record company.
Hmm.
And I really wanted him. I was in an elevator. He had gotten me a meeting with Lorne Michaels, the creator of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Lorne was looking for a new publicist.
Hmm.
And Paul had recommended me. And I had gone, Paul and Lorne own a building together. It's the former Brill Building on Broadway in Manhattan. And I'd gone up to see Lorne, and I was on my way back down in the elevator. And Paul Simon got in, and he was carrying a piece of paper with something printed on it. And I asked what he had, and he said it was the lyrics to his next album.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Can I see them?"
Mm-hmm.
And Paul handed them over, and I started to read them. And you have to realize something. Poetry had been important to me since I was about 14 years old, and it was so important to me that they thought I'd be the next great poet come mm-hmm. out of NYU. And they'd kidnap me to be the editor.
I remember
of
that.
Of a literary
yes.
magazine. Yeah, I didn't want to do that at all, but they forced me. Then we won 2 National Academy of Poets prizes. So
right.
I take poetry very seriously.
Mm.
And reading these poems, my knees began to give out.
Yeah.
You know, experience, have you ever had experiences where the thing just hits you so strongly that you have a hard time standing or you have to sit down?
A few times, but well, it has happened. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So that happened to me reading these lyrics.
Mm.
And I said to Paul, could I please have a Xerox of these? I want to send them to a friend at the New York Times and see if I'm crazy.
Yeah. Because
I think these are astounding.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, bless his soul, went to the Xerox machine with me and gave me a Xerox of his lyrics.
Mm.
And I hustled back over to my office. It was a 15-minute walk across Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And got on the phone immediately with my friend at the New York Times and said, look, I've just read these lyrics that nearly made my knees buckle.
Yeah.
If I send them to you, could you tell me if I'm crazy? And 2 hours later, he called back. I sent them my messenger. 2 hours later, he called back and said, no, you are not crazy at all. Well, I did that. I did that in part because I needed to.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to have a sanity check.
Mm-hmm.
And in part to set up Paul's album with the biggest publication in America, the most influential. It's not the biggest, but it's the most influential publication in America.
Right.
Because if the New York Times said positive things about something, everybody else in the media all across the country was going to say positive things about it.
Right.
But, and I would have loved to work with Paul, but I didn't get to do it. I probably would have loved to work with Madonna, who's a creative genius.
You know what's so funny? When I was reading your book, I thought about Madonna, and I felt like she had a place in there. And I don't know why, but it's just so funny that you bring that up.
Well, because she's the kind of artist who made genuine contributions. She took a technique that David Bowie used, and she built on it. And that technique is finding the most avant-garde people you can find who are able to do things for your stage show in particular that will just make people's jaws drop.
Mm.
And to use them for a year or two and take their key idea and run with it. And then drop them and pick up somebody else with new creative ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what David Bowie did. He was a creative vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Madonna did for her stage show. I never liked her music very much at all, but she had such integrity and she had such a strong sense of how to guide her own career that I really wanted to contribute what I could to that team. She was handled by the same Warner Brothers publicist that handled Paul Simon.
Okay.
And Warner's gave that publicist in the publicity business when I entered. Every publicist had at least 16 clients to work with, and that's more than a publicist can work with.
Mm.
My company established a new standard, 2.5 clients per publicist.
Okay.
Very different.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked to me like Liz Rosenberg, the publicist over at Warner's, was being allowed to handle two clients, Paul Simon and Madonna, and be just about full-time with the two of them.
Right.
And she was very good. So there was no way my clients, if they decided to go with her, were not going to be lacking anything, unless it was Prince. Prince needed me.
Yeah.
And Prince could not have just worked through Liz Rosenberg because he was black.
Right.
And in those days, there was a giant color barrier in the record company. And the black staff was on one side of that barrier, and the white staff was on the other side of the barrier, and there was no mixing the two.
And there was a giant push, right, to get black artists to move towards the pop industry. And
right, that's right. So that was a barrier we had to cross with Prince, and it wasn't easy. So Prince would, by the time when Prince first got started and was anonymous, nobody knew who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Liz Rosenberg would never have been given the assignment of doing Prince. Because nobody at Warner Brothers foresaw that Prince was not an R&B artist. He was a FM radio, rock radio artist.
Yeah.
That he was universal.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. I really enjoyed the part of the book where you talk about the secular shamanism with Prince and how it all came to full bloom with him. That whole chapter was really interesting. I really wish we had more time.
Right.
Next time.
And I wanted to quote his lyrics more extensively to Dirty Mind.
Oh my gosh.
But I couldn't do that because publishing companies that handle music lyrics would have come down on me like a ton of bricks.
Oh, I'm sure. And I had never teased apart the words before. You know, you just sing along sometimes and you feel what you're listening to, but you don't really tease it apart. So reading the lyrics and really going in depth just shook me.
Right. Well, I've paraphrased the songs for you.
You did.
So that you can know just how shocking those songs really are.
They're so
controversial.
And
then I've told you how many states, whatever the song's activity was about, how many states that activity is illegal in.
Exactly. Majority.
Right.
Oh my gosh. A great read. So if I could remake any movie and star in it, it would be?
Oh my God.
Probably
The Idolmaker, which I've never seen. But I certainly don't belong in the Clark Gable part in Gone with the Wind. So God knows. It might have been interesting to be in the part in 2001, A Space Odyssey, where he's traveling to God knows what. I can never make sense of that movie.
Yeah.
But, and everything is going psychedelic on him. I guess the implication is that there are these people from Jupiter who've been giving us our technology or something like that, and he's entering the mad and psychedelic realm of the people from Jupiter. Mm. Maybe that's what it's all about. I can't be sure. And maybe Harrison Ford movies.
The ones
with the guy with the hat who's the archaeologist.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Some of that could have been fun.
Those all make sense. Those are really great answers. One way to shine light online.
One way to shine light online?
Yes.
Well, you know, in 1988, when I got sick, my office had internet for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it took me 3 years. I was stripped of everything I thought was human. I no longer felt I had a human identity. Mm-hmm. And it took 3 years to reconstruct an identity. Mm-hmm. And I could only establish that identity in one piece of real estate, the cyber world, because I couldn't leave my bed.
Right.
And I discovered very rapidly that when you start flirting with people and I guess some crude equivalent of dating people and having romances with people online, your souls come alive because you have this unique privilege. We don't control whether we're handed a 350-pound body and an ugly face or not. Mm-hmm. Our physical appearance does not reflect us.
Right.
But when you're online and you don't see pictures, and in those days we couldn't see pictures, you make contact with that person's soul.
Right.
And that's all you know of that person. Mm. So the mere act of cyber romance is an act of soul. And it does make light online. Because passions flow.
Right. I didn't expect online. An answer, but that makes sense. That's a great answer. And this last one is, my name is Howard Bloom, and I am a...
an omnologist. Omnology is a field that I created a manifesto for in 2001, and it means that you will follow all of your curiosities simultaneously. It means you are omnivorously curious, that you have tremendous curiosity. It means that when you're in your sophomore year of college and you're interested in art history and you're interested in neuroscience and you're interested in cinema, your dad sits you down and says, now look, you got to make up your mind. You're going to be an art historian, a neuroscientist, or a filmmaker. Until you make up your mind, you're nobody. Mm-hmm. And omnology is there, so you can give the middle finger to dad and say, I'm sorry, dad, I'm an omnologist.
Right.
And I'm going to follow all those curiosities for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And so when you are 40 years old and all of your friends are having midlife crises And if they're women, they are coming up with elaborate plots to divorce their husbands so they can find out who they really are. And if they're men, they're buying sports cars and picking up blondes and cheating on their wives because they have no idea of why they are here on planet Earth. It all seems meaningless to them. Mm. At precisely that age, you will be coming back from the wilderness of your multiple curiosities with the very first of your answers. Mm. And you will be presenting things that are utterly unique because of the ways your multiple curiosities fit each other. Mm. You, if you're really lucky, will be coming up with big picture point of views that make sense of everything in whole new ways. So while others feel they're at the end of their lives, you will know you are just at the beginning of yours. That's omnology.
Wow.
So I'm an omnologist.
Well, I hope to be one too, I guess then.
Good.
That gives me, I'll take up a new challenge. Yeah, that's that was beautiful, Howard. Thank you so much for joining me today.
And thank you for having me.
It was
so
it was
I wish
so
you luck with the new podcast. May it go brilliantly.
Thank you so much.
And we'll see you again for the other questions on some other day.
That would be so wonderful. Have a great day, Howard. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.